FM.
Shalom from Machane Ramah in the Berkshires. This is Parsha Talk. I am Rabbi Elliot Malamud, and joining me today, Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanowski, Rabbi Barry Chesler. Gentlemen, shalom.
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 We have to start off with just giving a shout out to Adat Shorashim, Adat Sirin, and Samet Hofa, Miriam Hertzon, for the beautiful play that they did the other night, The CRB Tales, and featuring great depictions of the three of us. We were just so overwhelmed.
We loved it.
A great moment for both us and Ramah.
It was a great moment.
We thank Faith and the... Who played you guys?
I had Rachel Barnes.
Jared Levy. And they did amazing performances. So, way to go, Yoshi Koach. And looking forward to some great moments.
All right, let's talk about the Parsha, old timer.
Okay. My fellow old timers, we ended last week with the cliffhanger of end of Balak, and we deliberately did not go into the end of Balak because it requires some of its own concentration, its own time. What I want to do to start off today is read carefully the end of Balak with the episode of Pinchas. Pinchas, of course, the name of our parsha, starts off, he is rewarded for what he does, and this moment, this scene, occasions some great debate among our sages, our commentaries, and right down to today. So here we go. While Israel was staying at Shittim, the people profaned themselves by whoring with the Moabite women, who invited the people to the sacrifices for their god. The people partook of them and worshipped that god. Thus Israel attached itself to Baal Peor, and the Lord was incensed with Israel. So Vayitzamed Yisrael leBaal Peor, Vayicharav Adonai b'Yisrael. The Lord said to Moses, take all the ringleaders and have them publicly impaled before the Lord, so that the Lord's wrath may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to Israel's officials, each of you slay those of his men who attach themselves to Baal Peor. Just then, one of the Israelites came and brought a Midianite woman over to his companions in the sight of Moses and of the whole Israelite community, who were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting. When Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, saw this, he left the assembly, and taking a spear in his hand, he followed the Israelite into the chamber and stabbed both of them, the Israelite and the woman, through the belly. Then the plague against the Israelites was checked. Those who died in the plague numbered 24,000. And now at the beginning of this week's parsha, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, has turned my wrath from the Israelites by displaying among them his passion for me, bekano et kinati betocham, so that I did not wipe out the Israelite people in my passion. Say therefore, I grant him my pact of friendship. Hineni noten lo et briti shalom. It shall be for him and his descendants after him a pact of priesthood for all time, because he took impassioned action for his God, thus making expiation for the Israelites. It says, Tachad asher kinei lelohav vaychaper al b'nei Yisrael. Okay, who wants to weigh in on this? We have our scene. The scene is idolatry, terrible idolatry, a moment of the most flagrant kind of orgiastic excess that we can imagine, and that Pinchas is incensed. He takes matters literally into his own hands, taking a spear, stabbing the perpetrators through the belly, and then our parsha begins with a reward.
It raises a fascinating issue. The image of the text suggests that both Moshe and B'nai Yisrael were stunned into inaction. They did not quite know what to do, and only Pinchas was able to act. One of the, I think Milgram notes that neither the ringleaders are impaled, and there's another aspect I can't remember offhand that doesn't take place until Pinchas acts. He is the only actor. The problem, which is what makes it fascinating for me, is that looking back, we can evaluate Pinchas for good or for bad. But in the moment, it's very hard to know sometimes what to do. And I think sometimes in government and politics, paralysis is what carries the day.
Yeah, well, I mean, I find this a horrifying story on a number of levels. But I want to call attention to the fact that, you know, in the time of crisis, inaction is not a good thing. And yet, it seems to me that the text reflects a religious idea that terrible things have to be met with violence. Moshe, God tells Moshe, we have to have a symbolic punishment of the leaders. And I think our translation gave us ringleaders, although the text I don't think actually says they are ringleaders of the apostasy.
It's striking that it's in the third person. Right? God says, do this, and the Lord's wrath will be turned away.
Uh-huh. And then Pinchas comes along with his act of kina'ut, zealousness, and yes, it is true that the two people are having this kind of sexual flagrant rebellion, but the thought that what Pinchas has to do to avert the wrath, whether it's Moshe impaling the leaders or Pinchas stabbing the perpetrators, the thought that divine wrath is landed upon you unless you do an act of violence, is not a religion that I personally find a great deal of inspiration in. And I think that we in modern world can recognize that impulse and resist it, that impulse that says, when I see terrible things, I love God so much that I have to destroy the things that I find terrible. And obviously we live in a postmodern time. We have an ethos of trying to understand the other, not trying to slaughter the other. But we see in the world that, that ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whatever all too often says, I have to destroy these things which offend me.
So maybe the lesson is that we, as part of Amcha and our elected leaders or our chosen leaders, which Pinchas did not quite belong to at the moment, need to act before. That at some point, when violence erupts like that, it's already too late. And we've missed our opportunity, and we have to be vigilant to make sure that we don't get to that point.
Can I just say that turning to the rabbinic literature, on the one hand, it says in the Mishnah and Sanhedrin that bo'el aramit kena'im pogim bo. Do not try this at home, people. that if somebody were to engage in an activity like Zimri ben Salu and demonstratively, engage with an Aramean woman, a zealous person should stand up like Pinchas. But in the Yerushalmi Talmud, there's a great line that says, "Tani, it's taught in the Mishnah, Pinchas shelo biratzon chachamim." Pinchas acted against the direction of the sages, or at least against what the sages wanted. And to me, this represents the Bible coming as it does from an ancient world which could be much more brutal. The Bible tells a story of zealous violence, but the sages of the Gemara, who I think are fundamentally moderate people, and if they prefer they prefer discourse and conversation and argument to violence, say shalom ratzon chachamim. This is not what we want.
There are so many levels on which to think this through. I think what one of the levels here is really how to read biblical stories and how to put them in context, understanding that this story, while the first word on a subject, is certainly not the last word, and citing that piece of Talmud, and of course there are other pieces that make reference to this, that the act is not one to emulate. And yet, despite the fact that we may make the claim that the rabbinic tradition is a moderate tradition, there were certainly zealous figures among the rabbis, certainly figures who would have not only been apologetic to Pinchas, but would have, welcomed him and welcomed his act wholeheartedly, as there are, by the way, today. There are figures today speaking within Jewish circles who say, bring it on. Let's bring it on. Never mind, you know, the flagrant idolatry that warranted this. You know, they'll look to people who, in their own minds, commit other forms of idolatry or blasphemy or flagrant sinful behavior and say, bring it on. Let's.
The problem here, I think, is that in the Torah, it's clear, at least in the words of the Torah, what God says. We don't have that today. We can't say unmistakably that this is what God has told us to do. Pinchas, for better and for worse, can claim, at least in the context of our story, that he is doing God's word because
But it's even worse because it's perhaps even worse than that because Pinchas doesn't have the message and gets the warrant from God on the backside. He's already done it, and God says, "Oh, well done, Yasher Koach. Now we have a covenant of shalom." By the way, it's those of you who look in the Sefer Torah will notice that the vav in the word shalom is split. It's cut in half, so it's like two vavs. It's like a half a vav. And as if to indicate that Pinchas has desecrated shalom. It's like a little orthographic tradition of a commentary on Pinchas' behavior. Excuse me, but it's even a little worse than you said, because today the zealots could say, just like Pinchas, I need to act, and God will say, well done. I live in fear that certain of our extremists, excuse me, to our many listeners, sorry, Ben, sorry, Eric, I live in fear that some of the zealots around religious national issues are this very moment planning, as in the Machteret of the 80s, to blow up the Dome of the Rock. I think that would literally end the world.
Look, I remember hearing a lecture by Moshe Greenberg speaking about the book of Joshua, in which Joshua, you know, destroys the Canaanites and saying, basically warning that today you can read Tanakh, and the perils of reading Tanakh as the guidebook for how to behave in political and military ways.
Right. The real life problem, of course, is we can only look back.
Yeah.
We cannot look forward with any degree of certainty. Even when we say we have bitachon, confidence in God, it doesn't always help us in the immediacy of what we need to do today. After the fact, we can judge Pinchas. But no one could have said at the time he stood up that this was the right thing to do. And it's curious that the only reaction came from God. There is no human reaction to what he does.
I want to just kind of take a different tack on this for a second and ask a generational question, because it's Pinchas ben Aaron ben Elazar HaKohen. So Pinchas ben Aaron
ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen.
Thank you, Torah readers. Okay, so this is a grandson.
Yes.
This is a younger individual. To what extent is this a generational conflict in ancient Judaism, and to what extent does this apply generationally in common? And I'm thinking, you just came back from Poland, and you cite the book about Emanuel Ringelblum often. And in that book, there is the debate between the older generation and the younger generation as to whether or not to wage the rebellion. The older generation was in paralysis almost, or they were moderates. They said don't let slut rock the boat. Let's not do anything. The younger generation, Mordechai and Aloetz, let's go for it. We have nothing to lose.
I myself did not know until this recent trip in Poland that it's exactly as you said, that the older generation. And listen, nobody can blame people in the 1940s for not foreseeing the end of the depravity of the Nazis. I mean, if you say it's Haman, or you say it's Nebuchadnezzar or whatever, you could never have grasped where the Nazis were actually going. But I did not know until this most recent trip that the major deportations of hundreds of thousands of people left by the spring of 43, only 50,000 people left in the ghetto. It was when they had nothing left to lose that the young people overwhelmed the more moderate votes, because a quarter million people had already been murdered. But I think that Barry's comment about Moshe's paralysis and Pinchas's zeal fits exactly what you're saying about a generational sense, that those who feel like they have something to lose say, let's do this slowly. Those who say, you know, the whole world is before us, whether it's because of my youth or because I got nothing left, let's just, you know, let it all out there.
And the true cautionary note is that in any case that comes to us, we don't know until after the fact what indeed was correct. And we don't get do-overs in real life.
So we're going to leave this this issue here. And of course, you know, we've talked about this for years now, and it doesn't cease to yield its questions for us or reveal its questions to us. For the issues of violence and the limits of violence and how violence is perpetrated or understood within the tradition, and whether or not Pinchas is an archetype for us to follow, and I think our consensus is, of course, he is not, notwithstanding the fact that many people look to him and say, yeah, I want to be as zealous as he is. So let's move on into the Parsha and understand that the Parsha begins with a postscript of the previous Parsha.
It's, by the way, very interesting that, you know, the Torah didn't break it up into chapters like this, as you point out, Barry. It's interesting that not only did the Torah not break it up into chapters, it didn't break up the Parshiot either. And it's interesting that the history of Jewish Bible reading broke the Parsha in mid-story. You know, I don't really know what to do with that other than to say somehow they didn't want, either they didn't want the Parsha to end with resolution, last week's Parsha to end with resolution, or to begin with violence this week. I don't exactly know, but it's weird that it just really ends mid-story.
Well, we have been lingering with this question for an entire week, knowing that we were going to talk about this. You know, and so it gives us a sense of this anticipation and the need for resolution. And this happens in other places, by the way, in the Torah. The, you know, between Miketz and Vayigash.
Yeah, right.
You know, can't read Miketz without reading Vayigash during the Haftarah.
Right.
Right. All right. The census. So we have a second census here. B'nai Israel is now preparing for the conquest of the land. And there are a couple of highlights in the census. One highlight that we'd like to call attention to is Uvnei Korach lo metu, the sons of Korach didn't die. We recall Korach as the leader of the rebellion against Moses. Korach was swallowed up by the earth in addition to his cohort, who are still there, by the way, in the middle of the desert.
What are they saying?
They're saying Moses was true and we are wrong, and that is the definition of hell. To admit someone else is right and you are wrong. But B'nai Korach lo metu, why have the children, the sons of Korach, not died? And we point out that there are a number of lovely homiletical ways to read this.
So Rashi suggests that originally the sons were with Korach, and then they did tshuva. They recognized the error of their father's ways, and therefore a high place was found for them, so they did not descend entirely into the depths when the earth opened up. The comment I like, however, is from Chizkuni, who takes his point of departure from the fact that the B'nai Korach, who are Leviim, are mentioned in the census of Reuven, to draw a distinction between Datan and Aviram, the Reubenites who participated with Korach, and the B'nai Korach, and that the evil of Datan and Aviram was actually worse than the evil of Korach, because Datan and Aviram also influenced their children. And Korach's children were able to maintain the proper path despite their father.
I would observe about that, that it's something that I think that our Chanichim are probably unaware of, because we grew up with the Cecil B. DeMille epic, the Ten Commandments. And we know that Edward G. Robinson portrayed Datan, the gangster hero of the movies, played Datan. So we know, when we think of Datan, we think of Edward G. Robinson, who was like, he's a nasty guy. And I think Cecil B. DeMille was quoting Chizkuni in that respect.
All right. And then we get into the smicha. There is the sense of continuity of going to chapter 27, verse 15. Why don't we just dip into this piece of text. Because it's also a dramatic moment where Moshe is concerned about, or God is concerned about the succession for Moshe, 27:15, and here it is. Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "Let the Lord, source of the breath of all flesh, appoint someone over the community who shall go out before them and come in before them, and shall take them out and bring them in, so that the Lord's community may not be like sheep that have no shepherd." And the Lord answered Moses, "Single out Joshua, son of Nun, an inspired man, and lay your hand upon him. Have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before the whole community, and commission him in their sight. Invest him with some of your authority, so that the whole Israelite community may obey. But he shall present himself to Eleazar the priest, who shall on his behalf seek the decision of the Urim before the Lord. By such instruction they shall go out, and by such instruction they shall come in, he and all the Israelites, the whole community." Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and had him stand before Eleazar the priest and before the whole community. He laid his hands upon him and commissioned him as the Lord had spoken through Moses.
I want to point out one thing, that the passage just before what you began reading, Elliot, is God instructing Moshe to climb the mountain. And that, I think, is the reason why this moment of succession is so important, because this harkens back to the golden calf. The last time Moshe went up to a mountain, the people didn't think he was coming back, and they were left without a leader, and disaster ensued. This time, when Moses goes up the mountain, he wants to make sure that there will be someone to take his place that everyone will recognize and be able to see. It will not be the golden calf, of course. It will be the living body of Joshua, who will lead them as Moses did.
I think it's a remarkable insight. You know, going up the mountain is a perilous activity for Moses and for the people. And, of course, he dies on a mountain, as we will, you know, see after the summer. But let's just kind of relate to the ordination, the smicha of Joshua, the continuity here. Is there something that speaks out to you? I think the idea that it says that this is the way that they will go out, al piv yetzu v'al piv yavo. You know, there's an echo here about the camping of the Israelites, al pi Adonai yachanu v'al pi Adonai yisau, and now they are going to go with regard to a person's instructions. There seems to be a transition here from God himself directing the people to authority that is invested with God's authority to lead the people. God is kind of receding.
The other comment that striking is that Moshe speaks to God panim el panim. What characterizes Joshua? Why is he allowed to assume the mantle of leadership? According to the Pasuk, Isha Sheruach Bo, he has the Spirit of God within him, which is a little more evanescent than being able to speak to God face to face. And there's this recognition, I think, that Moshe's leadership was and always will be unparalleled. There will never be, as the Torah says at the end, a prophet who will rise up like Moshe. We're left with the very human figures of Joshua to lead us into the promised land.
I want to point out that Moshe asks God, and he confronts God with a particular epithet. He says, you've got Adonai Elohe Aruchot L'chobasar, the Lord, God of the spirits of all human flesh. And Rashi quotes a wonderful midrash saying, you know, God, you're going to have a leader who understands the differences among people. Everybody's different, and a really good leader knows the ruchot lechol basar, knows that one person deserves a certain kind of treatment, and another person deserves another kind of treatment, that leadership relates specifically to people. I'm not sure how many times that phrase appears in the Torah, but it does appear also in the rebellion of Korach, that Moses says at that point, as God is about to punish all the people, El Elohe Aruchot Lechol Basar, Ha'ish Echad Yechetav Al-Kol Ha'idah Yutzo, will you be mad at the whole community because of the sins of some? And using that phrase, one person can sin, and will you be mad at the whole community? And using that phrase, the ruchot l'chol basar, the unique spirits of each individual person, it's got a little poetic ring of trouble. So Moshe says to God, God, we need somebody who's going to be able to handle the fact that this people is going to have diversity, disagreement, rebellion, fractiousness. So the leader that you need is going to have to be someone who really understands people. I'm not sure that in the two countries that I love the most, that the leaders always understand the varieties of the people.
There's so much of a difference between Moshe and Joshua, and here it's a larger conversation as to, do the times define the leader, or does the leader define the time, or you know, Moshe couldn't have led the Israelites into the promised land.
Why not? I agree with you, and I have an idea.
Right. So there's the wisdom of ending his story at the boundary is that the agenda of leadership is never finished. That you and that there is a great deal of wisdom in providing some clear agenda for succession for the next leader.
So what comes to mind is Moshe from the beginning and until the end is a shepherd.
Yeah.
Joshua is a warrior.
Uh-huh.
Joshua battles Amalek. Moshe has to have his hands propped up because he's not a fighting man.
Mm-hmm.
And all the fights that he waged, people waged on behalf of him. Aaron represents him in the court of Pharaoh. The various armies go conquer the people that they meet along the way. And Moshe isn't really, I don't want to say he's not equipped, because I think that takes away from him, but he's not that kind of leader. He is the nurturing leader, I think, the shepherd, the one that comforts, the one that brings a moment of peace to the people in a way that a warrior never can.
There is a role that Moshe plays that Joshua simply doesn't play, which is that Moshe constantly mediates between God and the people in a way that Joshua never can aspire to, and that part of the relationship will forever remain a unique part of Moshe's role, to keep God at bay when God is overwhelmingly wrathful at the people, and also to allow Moshe to be the quintessential leader. And I would take just slight issue, not that Moshe is not a military man, but Moshe, you know, Moshe defines himself in the first years of his leadership with Israel. I mean, he's, according to the Torah, he's 80 years old, but he's the freedom leader. He takes them out of Egypt. He is the one that exercises diplomacy, or
but he doesn't fight his way out.
He doesn't fight his way
out. He uses other tools. And again, the image of the shepherd, which is one of the great images of the metaphor between God and Israel, and what is so powerful about the image of the shepherd is that the sheep know, I think, that they're never going to be the shepherd. Right? There's that distinction between the sheep and the shepherd that doesn't exist with other metaphors between God in Israel, and I think B'nai Israel knows that Moshe is unique, and Moshe, before God, is also in a different relationship.
Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for he is with me.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think that you speak now about Jewish tradition, not the Tanakh. Joshua is a great figure, but nobody ever says Yehoshua Rabbeinu. Like Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe is the teacher par excellence. He's a teacher of Torah. And Joshua is, I think you correctly said, I mean, among the things that some people can do and some people can't do, Joshua, he's got some moments where his final speech at the covenant renewal ceremony at the end of Joshua is powerful, but basically Moshe is a well-rounded, full spiritual leader, and Joshua is the leader of the moment. And I would say that we have a great tradition in Judaism. You know, you should go to the Kohen Asher Yehiyah Bayamim Hahem. You should go to the Kohen who will be in that day, the Torah says. And we're reminded that Yiftach Bedoro ki Shmuel Bedoro. Yiftach, who was kind of a thug and a bum when he was leader.
The Edward G. Robinson.
He was the Edward G. Robinson of his time. You know, counts as he was the leader at that moment, and Shmuel, with all of his wisdom and prophetic power, was the leader in his moment. And I do think that You know, if we walk around saying, oh, you know, why don't we have George Washington, why don't we have Abraham Lincoln, or why don't we have Ben-Gurion? That's just after I said a little comment about our current leadership. I do think that you can say, oh, woe is us if we only had Abraham Lincoln. But the reality is that, you know, different leaders are right for different moments. And maybe we say that, you know, Moshe was, you know, you and I like the Godfather, you know, that Moshe was not a wartime consigliere, and maybe we needed Joshua for that mission.
Right. Here's where we need to kind of bring it to a close. Of course, the majority of the material in the Parsha deals with Korbanot. This is the most often read Parsha of all the Parshiot. We're not going to discuss the Korbanot this week because it's part of our daily service. And of course, the content around Joshua, Pinchas, the census, the Bnei Korach, these are the things that captivate our imagination, certainly in the context of our Machaneh, where we are dealing with how to be a community. We are dealing with issues of leadership, transition, generational transition, you know, in the way that... you know, we, the elder statesmen of the camp, are depicted dramatically in lovely dramatic performances, and also in the way that we can convey the truths of Torah, which we have attempted to do this Shabbat. So for everyone, let's say Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.
שתיים נקודה שלוש FM.